Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport. Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast, a special Saturday morning edition. I am Terry Foy, joined today by a special guest, as would be appropriate for a special Saturday morning edition. Mark Hart, better known as Fieldy Stick on Twitter, one of the preeminent, and I don't say this with a pejorative tone, I just don't know what a better word is for it, let's call it amateur bracketologists. And Mark, really appreciate you joining. We've been wanting to do this for the last couple weeks, and certainly the results of Friday bore out the fact that it was very justified to hop on an emergency podcast for Saturday morning.
Absolutely. I think that it was a happy accident that we ended up doing this today, because we certainly have a lot to talk about. I do want to correct one thing, though. You said I was an amateur bracketologist. I want to correct that to aspiring bracketologist.
There you go. Love it. All right. Well, we're sticking with the A letter in the alphabet, but one of the things is credentials, right? I say it all the time when people ask my opinion of the bracket. I'm just like, hey, man, I'm just somebody that's been looking at the data for a long time. I don't want to be perceived, or I don't present myself as anything more than that. How do you describe, aside from the fact that you have a background in numbers, both academically and professionally, and you're a Johns Hopkins lacrosse fan, how do you describe how you came to this?
So my story with lacrosse bracketology starts in the run-up to selection in 2018. I was a senior at Georgia Tech and was following the selection, the conference tournament weekend. Hopkins was having a pretty good season, and I was starting to poke around at what their final seed might be. And I had so much fun doing that weekend in 2018 that I said, hey, I think I'm going to just try to do this the whole season next year to see how it goes. I would say our first contact actually came in 2021, when there was a lot of uncertainty about how the process was going to play out. And you gave me a shout out in an article you wrote for Inside Lacrosse about that uncertainty and how I was over on Twitter trying to make sense of it all already. So I really appreciate your kindness on that front. I'd say that's really where my work sort of took off and started getting noticed, was when I got that shout out from IL.
Right on. So every bracketologist has a point of view. I mean, you can probably use a different term for that, but let's just use the term point of view. What is yours? How do you describe either the way you go about assessing the data, or the way in which you seem to interpret how you might be differentiated from me or Patrick Stevens or anybody else who tries their hand at this?
So let's talk about, I guess, how you do this, and I'll sort of contrast, because I'd say your perspective is that at any given moment you do a bracketology, it's sort of if this were the final data. Is that correct?
That's right.
All right, so my perspective on that is, I would say that earlier in the bracketology season, like say early April, the RPI numbers are not final. I would say it's like baking a cake. It's still a little bit gooey at that point. I am not necessarily caring that Ohio State, for example, is 12th in RPI. I'm caring more about the two quality wins that they have in their wins column that are definitely going to hold up. Those two, in this case, being against Penn State and Notre Dame. Those are the two defining victories of their season. They have been top 10 RPI wins ever since they claimed them, and they will continue to be. So I'd say that's the real differentiating factor, is that I sort of take the approach that the RPI is going to work itself out into something representative and judge wins and losses more so than the at-the-moment RPI itself.
Got it. And you update more frequently than I do. You tend to update more recently to the given results, you know, so I tend to come out middle of the week. You tend to come out like earlier in the week. What do you think that does relative to the way in which you've developed an audience and how they interact with you?
I'd say that what you just said about having a schedule is very important in this business. When people know when you're going to publish, That's a big boon. I know that you're super busy with IL and you have lots of projects cooking, so I can forgive your lack of regularity on posts. But for me, it's always Monday morning, 9 a.m. as soon as the media poll comes out. And if it weren't for me waiting on the media poll, I would have it up sooner than that.
So, and then the last question is, you know, process-wise, how do you describe the visuals that you use? What about the way that you publish the different visualizations influences how you interpret the data?
So I'm assuming in that case you're talking about like sort of my spreadsheet of presenting
Yes.
wins of So basically, I'd say we're presenting the same data just in different ways. You're presenting it more in a table, and I'm presenting it as like wins and losses bracketed. I think it's helpful to see all these teams presented at once, is how I would say it. Is that if you just glance at my spreadsheet and you look at, say, Maryland versus Cornell, it just jumps off the page that Maryland has an incredible resume of wins currently. And maybe people who don't see it presented this way wouldn't pick up on just how much more impressive Maryland's wins are than anyone else.
All right, well, you kind of teed us up to get into the content, but before we do, I just want to shout out our friends. So this year, for the first time, we got our bracketology sponsored by Get Reps. It's a smart lacrosse ball, which somebody in your field, I would imagine, would find to be pretty interesting in terms of the ability to put a chip that has an accelerometer and a gyroscope and a battery and a Bluetooth emitter into a lacrosse ball and then use it to measure ball performance. So those guys have done an incredible job developing that product and certainly appreciate their support. And then as listeners of the Isle podcast have heard all season long, this podcast channel is sponsored by the NCAA and the Final Four heading back to Foxborough. Make sure to head to ncaa.com/laxtickets and enter Isle Pod at checkout to get $5 off any single game ticket option. We are getting much closer to knowing who is likely to be at Gillette Stadium on Memorial Day weekend. So once again, that's ncaa.com/laxtickets, Isle Pod at checkout. Mark, I mean, on a day like Friday or you know, recording this early Saturday morning before any of the games get started, it becomes difficult to decide which of the two places to start is more pertinent, more appropriate. Colgate, victors over Army. Syracuse, victors over Notre Dame. Which was the bigger result in your mind?
I think it was Colgate over Army because it really created a bubble. The other one, the Syracuse result, had it not been for Army losing, that result wouldn't have really changed anything on the bubble. But with Army dropping that game to Colgate, all of a sudden we have a discussion between most likely two teams for one spot.
Is Army out?
So last night on ESPN, Quint Kestnick said that given the stated selection criteria, it is difficult to see a path for Army. I would say that I would caveat that with if you look at the quantitative selection criteria, it's difficult to see a path for Army. But I absolutely can see the path for Army. It's through the regional advisory committee feedback.
Army currently sits at 12-2 with an RPI of 12, strength of schedule of 25. One of the, kind of salt in the wound components of how Friday night unfolded is that North Carolina had been a top five win for the Black Knights, but with their loss to Duke in the other ACC semifinal, the Tar Heels fell out of the top five. So what had been over the course of basically the entirety of the time I've been doing this, a differentiator in resumes, a top five win is no longer a feather in the cap of Joe Alberici's team. They have two additional top 20 wins, one being over Yale, the other being over Colgate, and they have no top 20 losses. We should add, and you know, I know that this is, you know, a little bit more of an easy comment for you because of the way that you see this, but part of this assumes that Richmond, who currently sits number 9 in RPI with the 20th strength of schedule, wins the A-10 and doesn't join this conversation of at-large bid seekers. But let's say they do lose, and let's say that means their RPI falls to 10 or 11, but still ahead of the Black Knights, with a record of 12-4 and no top 10 wins, but three top 20 wins. How do you stack up the Spiders' resume versus Army's?
So the problem I think Richmond is going to run into basically relies on what you just said. They're going to be the only team in that trio without a top 10 win, and there's not a lot of historical precedent for a team to get an at-large bid without a top 10 win. An additional negative differentiator for them will be that High Point is not going to finish in the top 20 in RPI, even with a win over Richmond. So Richmond will be carrying a 21-plus, quote, bad loss on their resume that neither of these other teams have.
So we've kind of already answered this question, but let's be explicit about it. Is Notre Dame on the bubble?
Terry, I think that's going to depend on how you define bubble. So if you take it as, quote, say the four teams around the bubble, the last two in, or the last two in and the last two or first two out, yes, Notre Dame is on the bubble. I'd say Notre Dame's resume, though, is quite a bit better than Army and Harvard. I would be very surprised if they end up on the bubble call at the very end of the selection process.
So just to make that a little bit more explicit, Notre Dame right now, a record of 8-4, RPI number 10, strength of schedule number 10, a top 5 win over Duke, a top 6-10 win over North Carolina, 3 top 20 wins over Virginia, Georgetown, and Michigan. Contrast that with Harvard, who is 10-4, has an RPI of 11, strength of schedule of 13, no top 5 wins. A top 10 win over Syracuse that has the potential to get marginally better, but I haven't seen whether the Orange will crack the top 5 in RPI if they beat Duke in the ACC championship. And then the Crimson have additional top 20 wins over Michigan, Yale, and Boston University. No bad losses. You think it's that it's the quality of that Duke win that differentiates Notre Dame, and what would happen, or how would you interpret it if Syracuse were to beat Duke in the ACC championship, and what that were to mean for the relative merit of those two kind of signature wins that each group has?
So in that case, Notre Dame, their best win is in the 6-10 bracket, just like Harvard and Army. The difference is that Notre Dame has more volume. Notre Dame has two such wins. Harvard and Army have one. Notre Dame is going to finish 10th in RPI. In simulations, there's no way they drop below Harvard or Army. So metrically, they have both of them covered. It's just difficult for me to see what you can poke at with Notre Dame to put them behind either of these other likely bubble teams of Harvard and Army. Yes, they probably should not be feeling 100% confident. Just because if you're in this range, on some level, you're leaving it up to the whims of the committee. But the committee also has to make a decision that is founded in data. And it looks to me like the data supports Notre Dame over these two.
So we should mention that the NCAA committee is a 5-person board that includes three athletic administrators, one from Ohio State, one, I believe, from Delaware, one from Rutgers, and then two coaches, a head coach, the former head coach at St. Bonaventure, Randy Mearns, and Kip Turner, the assistant at Virginia. Patrick Stevens, who I previously mentioned on this podcast, who does the bracketology prognostication for USA Lacrosse, interviewed the committee chair earlier this week. And I would say the biggest takeaway that I had from that was the chair's statement that basically it is the first back-to-back chair in nearly a decade. And his comment, it literally was something along the lines of, like, last year's criteria will be this year's criteria. What do you take away from that comment? What is important about that in terms of, you know, again, we kind of have to fold in what is always my comment, which is the NCAA selection criteria is either objectively subjective or subjectively objective, depending on how you want to interpret it. It is a set of objective criteria that is subjectively applied, meaning it can be applied in kind of whatever order the committee decides. And as a result of that flexibility, to your point, they can make decisions, and that's where whims become available as opposed to what would otherwise be an objective process. So again, back to the question, how do you interpret what is important about saying last year's criteria will be this year's criteria?
I would say that my takeaway from that is that you need to look at last year's decisions and see what you can draw from them. So think about our bubble call last year. It was Penn State versus Penn. They favored the team that had the better RPI, better strength of schedule, Penn State, not the team that had the one better win, which was Penn. I know that you and I differed on that bubble call, that you favored Penn and I favored Penn State. There were indeed arguments for Penn State, but they very much centered around that Penn, or for Penn, excuse me, but they centered around that Penn had the one best win of the two. However, it seemed to me like the committee favored the better metrics, the better volume. So maybe that's something we could look at this year that they may be favoring in a similar bubble call.
Very, very fair. But to your point, you know, right now, at least Notre Dame has better of both, right? They have the better wins and the better metrics. And that's kind of the point that you were making relative to the fact that, you know, they're safely in. Effectively, does that mean that we are looking at Harvard versus Army in terms of, and then, you know, how do you kind of parse out metrics versus quality wins between those two? Because, you know, effectively right now, it's equivalent or the same, meaning that Harvard has better of both.
You nailed it, Terry. I think we're looking at Harvard versus Army in a direct comparison. And the downside of that for Army is they look very similar. The loss to Colgate really tied them together. It eliminated the one way that Army maybe could differentiate themselves in a positive way, which was that Harvard was carrying a bad loss to Colgate. But now that's off the board, and Army's also carrying a loss to Colgate.
So another one of those questions that we've kind of already implied, but is worth it to make explicit because of how their fan base was reacting on the heels of what was a 3-game losing streak that now seems a little bit farther in the rearview mirror. Syracuse, currently 10-5, RPI number 7, strength of schedule all the way up to number 2. They don't have a top 5 win, but with a pair of wins over the Fighting Irish, they have 2 top 10 wins, 3 additional top 20 wins, Johns Hopkins, Colgate, and Virginia. What the question was, is Syracuse a lock? I suppose the question is kind of better phrased as, what do you make of Syracuse's resume right now?
I'd say all these ACC teams except Duke look the same. I mean, that's when you really sit down and look at it, Syracuse, Notre Dame, and North Carolina look very similar. So however you feel about Notre Dame is how you should feel about Syracuse. I would say Syracuse is a lock. They probably are not a lock for a home game just yet. If they lose to Duke, I'd say there's an argument they could be on the road. But they should definitely feel good that they're going to be in this tournament come tomorrow night.
That raises a really interesting and important point. Again, kind of a picadillo or one of the unique aspects of the lacrosse bracket is the fact that they seed the top 8 teams, do not seed the bottom teams, and it's 10, but it's, you know, effectively 8 because that includes 2 play-in games, that includes 4 conference AQs that then get funneled to the number 1 seed and the number 2 seed. Those 2 games are likely to be played on Sunday in order to accommodate the fact that those play-in games are going to be the Wednesday after Selection Sunday, this coming Wednesday. There are kind of 2 things that the committee tries to do, and the reason that they have that flexibility of not seeding the bottom 8 teams. Number 1, they try to limit the geographic travel. Basically, there's a rule that if the distance between the 2 sites is more than 400 miles, then the NCAA accommodates that by purchasing a flight for the visiting team. And they try to limit that to 2 matchups in the first round. And what that means is they try to make the other 6 matchups occur between teams that are less than 400 miles apart. There has been exceptions to that. I believe 1 year there was actually 4 flights in the first round, but last year there were 3. So it's not a hard and fast rule. And then secondly, they try to avoid conference rematches in the first round. And I believe there is 1 exception in the history of the bracket dating back to expansion to 16 teams, which is in 2003. I don't recall what that exception was, but generally speaking, it is a hard and fast rule, and it's going to be challenging this year because of this grouping of ACC teams. Right now, as I evaluate their resumes, I have Duke at 6, Syracuse at 7, North Carolina at 8, Notre Dame at 9. And, you know, what that would suggest is that if there was quote-unquote bracket integrity, which is a phrase that you hear, it was a phrase that the committee chair used with Patrick Stevens, that the number 9 seed should be going to the number 8 seed. But that represents a conference rematch. Not only that, there's also a very convenient solution to this geographic outlier situation insofar as Ohio State and more so Notre Dame aren't within 400 miles of a lot of the prospective opponents, but they are within 400 miles of each other. It makes it very easy for the committee to send Notre Dame to Ohio State in the first round. Not a lot of bracket integrity sending the number 9 team to the number 5 team, which is where I currently have the Buckeyes. Now, if you lose to Maryland in the Big Ten Championship, and then the winner of Duke-Syracuse can justifiably pass them, it becomes a little bit easier to send it to the number 6 or number 7 seed. But on top of that, in opposition to that, if Ohio State wins, then the question becomes how high can their resume climb? And then it becomes even more difficult to send, for example, Notre Dame. But it's not even Notre Dame, because if it's North Carolina or if it's Duke or whomever, even if it's Harvard, it becomes very difficult geographically to send one of those teams to Ohio State and then send Notre Dame somewhere else or send somebody else to Notre Dame. So my question for you is it a lock that we're just going to see Notre Dame go to Ohio State in the first round?
I don't think it's a lock, because I think if Notre Dame's seed climbs high enough, they can't justify it. You were talking about the lack of bracket integrity of having nine at, I guess, five with Ohio State for you, right? So in that case, yes, there's a lack of bracket integrity there. But if they really stick hard and fast to no conference matches in the first round, it's by definition the most bracket integrity you can possibly have, because six through eight are all ACC teams. So basically, there's two problems affecting this current bracket. That you have this glut of ACC teams right around the 8-9 inflection point, and also you have quite a few geographic outliers that don't have a lot of travel flexibility. So quickly, some examples of that would be Harvard, Notre Dame, Ohio State. All these teams have maybe one or two opponents that are within the 400-mile radius that we're looking at.
So kind of – I don't want to fully move on from this topic, but it also, you know, kind of flushes into it. I think that, you know, we haven't had an AQ awarded yet. That's what the next 39 hours are for. But you know, kind of very neatly, if Richmond wins, then it becomes very likely that the Spiders go to one of Duke or North Carolina, because, you know, that represents some very, you know, kind of easy geography. Are there any other matchups that you're looking at insofar as, you know, it is a kind of no-brainer? This is a matchup that I would expect.
Syracuse is a seed. I would say Harvard at Syracuse is pretty much a no-brainer, because it's the only option for Harvard that isn't going to be a flat. A sneaky one that I have caught on to is that Georgetown to Ohio State, depending on how you measure it, comes in just under 400 miles. And that might be a way to escape the Notre Dame-Ohio State problem we were talking about.
As somebody who has made the trip, not from D.C. to Columbus, but from Baltimore to Cleveland many, many times, yes, it is right there on that. And it's the last 40 miles that kill you. It's like, aren't we there yet? Come on! Much easier trip to make in a bus when you're asleep than it is when you're actually driving. All right, let's kind of move from the 8-9 inflection point to the top of the bracket, because, you know, there are three inflection points in every bracket, and we've already covered two of them, basically last in, first out, and then last team to get a home game. But what about the number one seed? How does that race shape up for you? And I guess I'll ask it even more directly. Is Maryland in the conversation for the best resume of all time?
Absolutely. But there is a little bit of a caveat to that Rutgers has slipped out of the top 20 in RPI, and Maryland has currently picked up a, quote, bad loss to Rutgers. So that's a little bit of a negative differentiator in Maryland's clear claim to number one. I would say that me and you both had pretty much the same reaction to the interim rankings that had Cornell ahead of Maryland of, wow, that's really surprising based on the data we've been looking at, because it looks to me like this Maryland team is clearly the best resume on paper. Would you agree with that?
I would, yeah. So right now the Terps are 11-2. They have the number one RPI and number one strength of schedule. They have three top five wins and a pair of wins over Penn State and one over Princeton. They have four wins in the 6-10 range, Richmond, Syracuse, Notre Dame, Ohio State, and two additional top 20 wins over Johns Hopkins and Virginia. That number nine, the number of nine quality wins is insane. And like one of the more impressive numbers that I've ever seen. And I think that is where a huge portion of that comes from.
So Cornell has been, I know polls don't matter for the bracket stuff. Cornell has been number one for most of the season. And I think that's why a lot of people seem a little surprised that we keep evaluating Maryland as the likely number one seed, is that there's a disconnect between the polls and what the data is actually showing us in terms of how we're supposed to think about the selection criteria.
It's a really good point, and it's a really good time to make that point. So the Big Red are 13-1, number three RPI, number 16 strength of schedule, a top five win over Princeton, two top 10 wins, one over Richmond, one over Syracuse, and then three additional top 20 wins, Yale, and Harvard. Princeton checking in with the number two RPI, number eight strength of schedule, two top five wins, Penn State and Duke, one additional top 10 win over North Carolina, three additional top 20 wins over Harvard, Yale, and Harvard. So That number 16 strength of schedule for Cornell, how much of a yoke do you think that is around their resume's neck? And then I guess an adjacent question is, do you feel like the Ivy League championship game between Princeton and Cornell is for the number 2 seed, or can you see a scenario in which, especially if Maryland loses to Ohio State in the Big Ten championship, it's actually, you know, especially if it's Cornell that wins the Ivy League, it's for the number 1 overall seed?
So I'll answer that in two parts. The strength of schedule issue for Cornell, I do think it's going to be a problem, because not only does that relate to them, their profile in terms of just raw metrics, it's also affecting their quality wins in a way, because if you play a weaker schedule, you by definition have fewer chances at quality wins. There are four basic scenarios here, and we don't necessarily have to go through all four of them, but you have two different winners in the Big Ten championship and two different winners in the Ivy League, so you end up with four scenarios. I would say that the winner of the Princeton-Cornell game is going to definitely be ahead in the seeding. And if it's Cornell who wins the Ivy League, I could see them getting the number one seed, especially if Maryland loses.
Is there anything with respect to the bracket that we haven't talked about?
One that I wanted to talk about a little bit is, I get the feeling that you'll see from the Army fan base a little bit of poking at Army should be ahead of North Carolina.
I agree. What do you say to that?
I would say that if North Carolina were in the bubble conversation, that is certainly a conversation that you, or an argument you could present. I think the problem is going to be that the committee is going to be evaluating North Carolina in this group with most likely the other ACC teams, like 6 through 9, not with Harvard and Army, and in what they ultimately have to decide is two teams for one spot. That North Carolina just looks a little bit better overall in terms of wins, losses, and metrics than the actual bubble team.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's, you know, one of the elements that we can kind of end on, which is the role that RPI plays in this selection. So, you know, for those that aren't aware, RPI stands for Ratings Percentage Index, and it's calculated differently depending on the sport. In men's lacrosse, it is calculated by 25% your own win percentage, right? So say you've won 75% of your games, multiply that by 0.25. That is the first quarter of your RPI. The middle 50% is your opponent's record, so basically your strength of schedule. And then the last 25% is your opponent's strength of schedule. Then RPI is also used to determine your strength of schedule. It is what the number that underpins your that strength of schedule is. Again, kind of going back to the point about, you know, committees interpret, you know, the individual 5-person unit interpret data sets differently. There has been points in time when committees have said RPI is not itself a criteria, but it is the order by which we consider teams. And so that's effectively how I go about doing it, meaning that I compare teams. So basically, you put 1 versus 2 in RPI next to each other. You don't necessarily consider the fact that the RPI is 1 versus 2, but you consider the strength of schedule and the quality wins and say, all right, which of these two teams, or and bad losses, which of these two teams' resumes is better? And then you make the decision, you move on to the next one. Let's just say, because it makes the example a little bit easier, you think number 2's resume is better, and then you just compare number 1 in RPI to number 3. All right, which one's better? And if, you know, in this case it's number 1, then you compare 3 to 4. Which one's better? And so on and so forth. And so I think that's the point where the 5-team gap in Carolina's RPI to Army's RPI means that they are unlikely to be compared against one another. And, you know, that's kind of the nut of it. And I think that your point is well taken when it comes to interpreting last year's committee decision of the criteria and what we learn in it and how it informs this year. And really, it's not just last year. It's also kind of a trend. I posted this on Twitter yesterday, basically the lowest RPI team selected for the tournament dating back to 2010, and the number has gotten considerably lower over the course of the last, call it 5 or 6 years, which suggests, it doesn't necessarily clearly and explicitly state, but it suggests that the committee is valuing RPI more highly. So last year, the last 2 years, in fact, the lowest rated RPI team that got an at-large bid was 9. And that is legitimately only one spot removed from the mathematical low. The lowest possible is 8, which just again suggests that the committee is adhering to RPI more closely. Whereas if you go all the way back, let's just say in, 2016, Carolina got in with the RPI of 17. In 2014, Harvard got in with the RPI of 16. In 2010, Notre Dame got in with the RPI of 18. So, yeah, again, to reiterate the point, we're led to believe that RPI is not a criteria or not a criterion, but it is the order by which the resumes are considered. And I think that to underscore your point, that's why it's going to be Harvard versus Army for the last spot as of right now, and it isn't going to include Carolina in the consideration.
So while we're on the topic of RPI, I have two little pet issues I want to discuss. One of them is a fact and one of them is an opinion. So I see discussion of RPI on Twitter being talked about as being, quote, the computers. RPI is not a computer. It's just a formula. It's a very simple formula. You can actually calculate it by hand if you want to, and you have a lot of free time. I wouldn't recommend doing that, but you can do it. The RPI is not a mystical black box that no one understands how it works. It's just a simple formula. And number two, I see an opinion that RPI is somehow inherently biased or flawed. And I would sort of push back against that. The teams and conferences that are high in RPI are high because, in general, they win games. That the RPI favors teams that win games and schedule difficult opponents. That's basically all it is.
And so there are a couple of ways to maximize your RPI that you could call gaming the system if you wanted to, but it's not really, to your point about RPI is not a complicated formula, the method of gaming RPI is also not very complicated. It is play as few games as you are required to play and schedule only opponents that have very good records. And, to an extent, it matters less how good their records are relative to how good their opponent's records are. Because again, it's a 50% versus 25% metric. So point being, if you're better off scheduling the best team in a big weak conference, say Sacred Heart, who is going to go 12-4 relative to, say, Notre Dame, who is going to go 8-4 against a better set of opponents, because that 12-4 in your 50% bracket that you got from playing Sacred Heart is going to be it's going to be multiple points more valuable than that win over an 8-4 Notre Dame. There are teams and coaches who have mastered this. Look at Maryland's schedule. John Tillman is incredibly good at scheduling teams in the types of conference situations that we just described. Andy Shea has been very good at it over the course of the last 5 or so years. Penn and Notre Dame are the teams that have really adhered to that play 12 games and play only good teams component, and that's why Penn's RPI is almost always, 5 to 10 spots higher than where they tend to sit in the media poll. And so the point is that this is an objectively evaluated thing, and what we do is interpret how they can be subjectively applied, which is kind of a bizarre, but the note that I want to end on. Are you in favor of scrapping this and moving to a fully objective system like we have in men's ice hockey?
So I'm not super familiar with pairwise. I haven't looked at it in depth. That's what's used in hockey as far as I understand. What I do think is a possibility is that we might be moving toward the NPI system that's being used in D3. And I would caution against that if you're a mid-major, because I actually think that the way we're doing this currently with a subjective evaluation of objective data might be more favorable to those kinds of cases than just a formula with NPI that spits out who's in and who's out. Because if that formula does favor just winning games more than, say, scheduling very difficult schedules, you're going to see a glut of ACC teams and Big Ten teams and Ivy League teams all go 10-3. And then they look just like this Army team. And what's Army's case then? Because the teams in the big conferences will schedule to whatever the selection criteria rewards. So at least in this system, Army does have a case to send the committee. If you go fully objective, there is no committee to make that decision for you.
Well said. And I guess that's a good note to end on, because we're going to put this into the committee's hands as we see the final 11 games of the 2025 NCAA Men's Division I regular season come down. And the curtain rise on the NCAA tournament. Mark, it's the best time of year. Really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much for joining. And can't wait to debate whatever madness unfolds over the course of the next 2 days.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Terry. And everybody enjoy the games today.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.